Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We begin the hour with the underworld of organ trafficking. Then, discoveries are challenging what we learned in our biology class about what makes us male or female. And finally, revolutions and mass movements are not what they used to be. We'll explore what's changing. The World Health Organization estimates that illegal organ traffickers obtain about 7,000 kidneys per year. The victims are often among the poorest people in the world, who either sell organs to get by or are murdered for them. Nancy Shepherd Hughes joins us. She is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include Commodifying Bodies and Violence in War and Peace, an anthology. We're also joined by award-winning bioethicist Art Kaplan. He is director of the Center for Bioethics at University of Pennsylvania and editor of books, including Smart Mice, Not So Smart People. Nancy Shepherd Hughes, how prevalent is this? Where are the illegal activities happening, and what more do we know?
Well, we know a lot. The landscape changes year to year because it is an underground economy. It's a shadow economy, and it opens up in one country. Police get alerted, and the people move on, and they find another place to operate. But there are some places where it's very, very entrenched, and, you know, in this trade in organs, you have what I basically following some of the trafficking literature. You've got donor countries where people are recruited to sell, and you've got recipient countries or areas where people are inclined to need to travel to get a transplant. And then you have facilitating countries, and that's where the operations take place. In some cases, everything happens in one country, in other places within two. So, I mean, where is it? It's in South Asia. It's Southeast Asia. It's in the Middle East. It's in the United States. It's in Latin America. The Philippines, India, Pakistan, Egypt are, you know, places where this has really become quite entrenched. China. But in each place, it's somewhat different. You know, China was using executed prisoners. They got in trouble for that. They passed some laws. Now it's moved to living paid donors, and that's not a good option. It's a hard thing to get the world together on in order to police it properly and to make sure that the worst, most egregious brokers and outlaw surgeons are stopped and prevented. But they seem to be very mobile. They seem to be ahead of the police all the time, and they just move from place to place.
I just heard you say outlaw surgeons.
Yeah, they're outlaws because they're willing to break existing laws in the countries where they're operating. Although I understand that the laws are sometimes a bit murky, most countries that do transplants do have pre-existing older laws that say commerce in tissues and organs is illegal. But often the exact standards, the exact penalty for doing this might be vague. In some countries, it's clearly explicit that you can't sell, but it doesn't say anything about can you buy an organ. So, yeah, there are some loopholes. But in general, organs trafficking is, and human trafficking for organs is covered under the UN Convention, what commonly called the Palermo Convention, and certainly by most of the existing regulations within international transplant.
The gentleman that was arrested was running a trafficking ring.
Rabbi Rosenbaum.
He had been engaged in this for about 10 years. You had alerted FBI, I think, 7 years before they did anything.
Yeah.
How prevalent is this organ trafficking in the United States?
Well, it takes, in the United States, different forms. Isaac Rosenbaum was linked to a network that was operating globally, but through key brokers, or really criminal businessmen in Israel. So he was part of this very extensive network that moved people around from Israel to Turkey to Moldova to the Ukraine, Romania to Baku and Azerbaijan to the United States, where they operated in Brooklyn and in Philadelphia and in Maryland and in California, in Los Angeles. So that was one particular network, but there are others. Within India, there's a network in which primarily wealthy Indians, especially diasporic Indians living abroad, go back to India and get transplanted. Lots and lots of people in Asia go to the Philippines. The Philippines is a key site for kidney selling and buying. And a lot of people in the sort of Gulf states and in the Middle East go to Egypt. Iraq, before the war, was a major area for buying and selling organs.
Let's bring Art Kaplan in. There are multiple ethical issues that are tied up in this organ trade. One is the need for organs. One is people who are selling them are in dire enough straits that they're willing to sell parts of their bodily integrity. And the confidentiality between physicians and their patients. How do we address these ethical issues?
Well, there is tremendous need, and Nancy's given a rather sad and accurate picture about the extent to which a black market evolves among particularly poor nations and poor countries to meet that need, but it doesn't really meet the need in a systematic way. What you have is countries, they're not getting organs, and we're talking primarily here about kidneys when we're talking about buying and selling things. They don't have organs coming from cadavers, from the dead, as we do in the United States. They don't develop that system. Their incentive to do it is somewhat lessened. If they think locally they can buy an organ or a kidney from a poor person, they don't do it. You find around the world transplant centers winking and nodding, not doing very intensive interviews because of people who come and say, yes, I want to donate my kidney to my good friend, I think her name is Nancy, my good friend. So they're not checking to see whether I actually know Nancy or cousin as I claim. But, you know, good enough, I'm here and let's go. Their orientation of the transplant centers is to get organs to the people who need them. They make money doing that. They save lives doing that. They're not oriented toward the donors or sellers in the case of this black market situation. So they don't have representation. They don't have voices. They tend to be the ones exploited. I don't think this is the solution, and I would add, when you really start looking at the issue of poor people, and some would say, well, you know, they can make some money, they're poor, this is helpful. What we found in a study that I just headed up for the United Nations and the Council of Europe on organ trafficking was that people don't work their way out of poverty by selling a kidney. The most desperate people sell. People have no other options, no work. It's a one-shot deal. They pay off a debt, and they're back in poverty again. If you wanted to say, well, maybe this market does some good for them, it really doesn't bring them any sort of economic benefit or boon. And the middlemen who handle this trade exploit them, rip them off for costs of travel, food, everything you can think of. They're charging these poor souls, so they don't really come out ahead. It's not a situation where they're coming out better than they were because they sold a kidney.
As I understand it, the United States is lagging from some of the other nations in dealing with the issues of the organ trafficking. Nancy, perhaps you can address this first.
To the extent that we have codes of confidentiality between doctors and patients, and there's a reluctance for the hospital nephrologist or the transplant coordinator or the committee that's in charge of really seeing that the law, NOTA, which our law against buying and selling organs, is being followed. And so the questioning is minimalist. And when I've found hospitals where there has been some consensual buying and selling where people find each other online, but also in New York City when Isaac Rosenbaum was working and some of his associates in the Philadelphia area, they actually did bring in people who were trafficked. They may have initially agreed, but they got to the States and they wanted to get out. And I had a person from Isaac Rosenbaum's network call me and say, I need to get out of this because we're forcing people to do this. I don't mind if people want to buy and sell, but we've had people coming from poor countries. We have Ukrainians, Moldovans, poor Israelis that are coming here. They're getting frightened and they're being told that they have to get up on a table and sell. Now, the fact that the hospitals failed to catch that can only be that there was really a lack of due diligence. If people can't speak the same language, if they seem frightened of each other, if there seems to be a hesitancy. Well, I can tell you that in Europe, I spoke at the House of Lords with a group of very informed experts about how you really regulate this. And in the UK, they said, we have no problem with investigating. And we don't say, oh, we're policing, or we don't say, oh, we become, you know, immigration offices. Basically, if somebody says they're related, we say, oh, well, show us some proof that you're related. So they really do ask for proof, and I've never run into a medical center in the United States where that is customary. I don't know, maybe Art has found that.
Very few, unfortunately, and it's the most simple thing. You'd think they'd want to establish
right
identity, and very few do. Very few. And again, it's partly because I think they are oriented towards saying, let's get the kidney for the people that need them, and we can make money if we put them in. We need kidneys. We got a lot of capacity to do operations. It's very lucrative. Yeah. We're not oriented, I'm talking for the transplant team now, toward detection of donor benefit and interest.
Thank you so much. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Textbook biology teaches us about how our X and Y chromosomes determine our sex, but scientists say it's more complicated than previously understood. Melissa Wilson-Sayers joins us. She is a fellow at the Center for Theoretical Evolutionary Genomics at the University of California, Berkeley. Jeremy Nathans also joins us. He is a research investigator at Howard Hughes Medical Institute and professor of molecular biology and genetics, neuroscience, and ophthalmology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome, Jeremy Nathans, and welcome, Melissa Wilson-Sayers. Great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. Both of your studies looked like it was turning a little bit of textbook biology on its head, this idea that our X chromosome and Y chromosomes come together in the case of the female as a double X and as the male with the XY. It seems like there's a little more complication than what we previously understood. How have we understood the function of these two chromosomes before now? Jeremy Nathans, why don't you start?
Well, in all mammals, including people, the sex of a child is determined by which chromosomes he or she inherits from their parents. If a child receives one X chromosome from the mother and one X from the father, she'll be a girl. If a child receives one X from the mother and a Y chromosome from the father, he'll be a boy. And that has been known for a long time, but the interesting recent work explores the structure of the chromosomes and also the way in which their genes are activated or inactivated in patterns in each of us.
Some of what you have found is that this X chromosome is a little bit more mysterious because of the way it chooses activation or inactivation. Can you walk us through some of this?
The original discovery was made around 1960. Mary Lyon, a British mouse geneticist, was the person who put all the pieces together and came up with this most striking hypothesis, which turns out to be right, that in every cell in every female mammal, one of the two X's is chosen to be inactive and the other is chosen to be active. And that means that each female is a mosaic. There is a mixture of cells, some expressing the mother's X chromosome and others expressing the father's X chromosome. And that mechanism has very interesting medical and biological implications. For example, if a woman is carrying one mutant gene on one of her two X chromosomes, then effectively half of her cells on average will be completely mutant and the other half will be completely normal. That's quite different from the case when a gene is on a so-called autosome, one of the standard chromosomes, in which case one gene from the mother and one gene from the father are present, and if one of them is mutated, the other one generally fills in, and although perhaps there will be only half as much of the resulting gene product produced, it's usually enough to keep the cell going. So it creates in females the possibility for variation from one cell to another, one place in the body to another, or one tissue to another.
Which is not present in males.
Yes. So females have an extra level of genetic complexity. I think this certainly resonates with our recollections of junior high school when the boys were, as you probably recall, rather simplistic in their social interactions and the girls were very sophisticated. At least it seemed to me that way.
One of the things that you had said was it could be that one side of the brain is completely dominated by one parent, while the other is the other parent.
To give a little bit of background of our recent work, we've asked in laboratory mice exactly which cells express the mother's X chromosome and which ones express the father's X chromosome. And this was possible because genetic engineering methods allow one to insert genes that encode fluorescent proteins of different colors into mouse DNA. In our case, we engineered mice so that they would produce a red fluorescent protein from one of the X chromosomes and a green fluorescent protein from the other X chromosome. And so every cell in the body would be either red fluorescent or green fluorescent. Those mice reveal the pattern on a cell-to-cell basis of the activation of either the mother's or the father's X chromosomes. So we can see, for example, within the brain to us seemed like the most interesting place to look. We could see exactly which cells or which regions expressed which of the two chromosomes. And as you noted, in some of the mice, it was a minority, but perhaps one out of five, there was a clear difference between the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain. That seemed to us especially interesting because we know in humans that the left and right sides of the brain are different. The left side of the brain generally has the language area. And one possibility is that some of the difference between the left and the right sides of the brain arise from this sort of X chromosome mosaicism, at least in females. Of course, males would not have that option. But for females, there may be some left-right brain differences that are really due to this special mechanism.
One theory suggested that this genetic versatility, females tend to have more than males, may spare them from some genetic disorders.
Yes, that is certainly true. So the typical genetic disorder that resides on the X chromosome, when the gene for that disorder resides on the X chromosome, the effect of a mutation in that gene is to completely inactivate the corresponding function in a male who carries that because he has no backup copy. In a female, there's the possibility that the roughly 50% of cells that have the normal version of the gene will make up for, or at least partially make up for, the deficiency. A classic example would be hemophilia, a defect in blood clotting. This was most famously carried by Queen Victoria, and she had no problem because 50% of her cells were making quite enough of the blood clotting protein. But among her grandchildren, most famously the young man who would have become the future czar of Russia if the Bolsheviks hadn't intervened, he had only the defective copy, and he had the full-blown disease.
Melissa Wilson-Sayers, you've been looking at the Y chromosome. There's been some thought that that Y chromosome is starting to change, and you've confirmed this to some extent. How is it changing, and how does this manifest itself?
We kind of study two sides of the coin. I agree that the X and Y chromosome are the most interesting parts of the genome. What's fascinating is that we know that the human X and Y chromosome used to be identical, roughly 200 million years ago. And at that point, the Y chromosome acquired a gene called SRY, sex-determining region of the Y, and it became sex chromosomes. And over the last 200 million years, the Y lost about 90% of the genes that it once shared with the X chromosome, and that's led some people to speculate that in the next 5 million years, it might just continue to shrink into nothingness. And what we show is that is very unlikely to happen. So what we did is we compared actually the whole genome, so the whole complement of the non-sex chromosomes, the X chromosome, the Y chromosome, and this little circular piece of DNA called the mitochondria. At the whole genome, we see that across human males, across the globe, on the Y chromosome, variation is much lower than we expect it to be. And that was surprising. And so there's been conflicting hypotheses about that. One of them is that there is variance in male reproductive success. And this is that some men father many children, and some men father few or no children. And if you think about that, then it was explained, if you inherit a Y chromosome, you develop as a male. Well, if there's just very few males passing on their Y chromosomes, then you'll just have lower variation on the Y chromosome because you'll be much more related. What we show is that that's not the whole story. That might be happening a little bit, but that's not sufficient to explain the low Y variation. We need an additional force, which is natural selection, acting to purify out harmful mutations on the Y chromosome to observe the low levels of variation. Why this is fascinating is it means that natural selection is still acting on what is left on the Y chromosome. So even though there's only 27 unique genes, the X has approximately 1,100. Those 27 are very important and are likely to stick around for the foreseeable future.
One of the things I found confusing was that there have already been some mammals that don't have a Y chromosome. And if this is so, which ones and what does that mean really about the Y chromosome and maleness?
Although the Y chromosome occurs in males only, we shouldn't think about it as needing a Y chromosome to be a male. What you actually need are the genes that are on the Y chromosome. And you're right, there are some species, so there's an Okinawa spiny rat where it doesn't have a Y chromosome anymore. But what we think happened is that the genes on the Y chromosome fused to one of the non-sex chromosomes. And now what we have there is a novel, young sex chromosome system. And those that non-sex pair that now has the sex-determining region, those genes from the Y chromosome, that will become a new sex chromosome pair, and it will start to degrade and go through the same process that our sex chromosomes have gone through. So although we do think that the genes around the Y chromosome are very important, they're likely to stick around for a while, if something were to happen to that chromosome, the genes would still persist somewhere in our genome, and we wouldn't lose males. So there's no need to worry. We're not going to become some Amazon-specific female-only society.
What a relief.
Yeah. Now, what about people who have XYY chromosomes? What does this mean?
So there are people with a single X chromosome, X-naught. This is Turner syndrome. There are people that are XXY, Klinefelter syndrome. They present as male. There's XYY. You can have a lot of variations. And so this is where there's actually a huge bridge between our work. Generally, you need that SRY, that sex-determining region of the Y, to turn on this transcriptional pathway that will turn on the formation of testes and making sperm. And so if you have that SRY, whether you have two Ys or whether you've even just moved that SRY and some of the related genes to a non-sex chromosome, the male determining pathway will still be turned on. That's interesting when you talk about the differences in the chromosome. So there can be XXX individuals, and they still undergo this X inactivation. I'm sure that's kind of an interesting link between these. All of the non-sex chromosomes, you inherit one copy from the paternal lineage and one copy from the maternal lineage. So you have two copies of everything. And on the sex chromosomes, it's different. So females have one X from their mother, one from their father. But males have one X from their mother and one Y from their father. And the problem is, whereas all of the non-sex chromosomes have a partner to swap with if there's any mistakes anywhere, the Y chromosome doesn't have a partner. If there are mistakes that accumulate on the Y chromosome, it doesn't have a partner to swap with to get rid of those mistakes. And so if those mistakes are severe enough, if they lead to infertility, if they lead to sperm that don't swim properly or have misshapen heads, then you have to get rid of that entire Y chromosome. And in doing so, you get rid of the harmful mutation, which is a good thing, but you also get rid of all of the neutral variation that's accumulated on that chromosome.
One aspect of the Y that's especially fascinating is that because it's inherited from father to son, to grandson, to great-grandson, and so on, without ever having the opportunity to swap information with another Y chromosome, then it's essentially a pure historical record of what happened with each generation, going all the way back to the proverbial atom. So wonderful example of the way that's been used in anthropological research is, for example, if you look at the exact sequence on the Y chromosome of Jews whose last name is Cohen, Cohen in Hebrew means priest, what you find is that they share the same DNA signature on their Y chromosomes. Why? Because the last name has traditionally gone down in the family from father to son, just the way the Y chromosome has. And initially, the priesthood was also inherited in the same way. That is, the son of a priest became a priest, and so on. And so going back thousands of years, the same Y chromosome has been handed down from father to son among those whose last name is Cohen. And there are many other examples like that.
Melissa Wilson-Sayers?
There was one individual that had our whole genome. And what it really means is that for every part of our genome, for the non-sex chromosome, for the every piece of the X chromosome, for the Y chromosome, and which is inherited through the male lineage, and for the mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited through the female lineage, you can find a most recent common ancestor. But there's no one individual that had the common ancestral sequence of all of those. The time to the most recent common ancestor of the Y chromosome, while it's extremely useful in looking at the population of the world, the person who had the Y chromosome, that is the ancestor of all living Y chromosomes, had non-sex chromosome DNA from thousands of people and shared between thousands of people. And you can think about it in a family. If there is one son, he shares his Y chromosome with his father and with his grandfather, but his non-sex chromosomes came from his father and his mother and his two maternal grandparents, his paternal grandparents. So we're huge composites, and we hold a whole evolutionary history in our genomes.
Jeremy Nathans.
That's a beautiful way to look at it, because each of us is unique many times over. Our genomes are completely different, with the exception of identical twins who have the same genomes. But each of us has a combination of historical records built within our genome that gives us a wonderful uniqueness, and I think that's something to celebrate.
Thank you so much, Jeremy Nathans and Melissa Wilson-Sayers. It's been a great pleasure to have you with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much.
When we come back, revolutions and mass movements are not what they used to be. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. The 21st century has already witnessed revolutions in Ukraine, Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, alongside other uprisings and transformational movements that reach all over the world. But although these movements have their roots in earlier movements and revolutions, they are different from their predecessors. For one, these movements are increasingly nonviolent. And secondly, they're less ideologically driven. We have three experts with us. Leandra Vergara Camus is professor at the Department of Development Studies at the University of London. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Land and Freedom, the MST, the Zapatistas, and Peasant Alternatives to Neoliberalism. John Foran is professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of The Future of Revolutions, Rethinking Radical Change in an Age of Globalization, and Taking Power on the Origins of Revolutions in the Third World. Jack Goldstone is professor of public policy at George Mason University. He's the author of Revolution and Rebellion in the Early Modern World, Revolutions, A Very Short Introduction, and the co-editor of Political Demography, How Population Changes Are Reshaping International Security and National Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We seem to be having a lot more revolutionary activity, and I wanted to understand the 21st century revolutions as opposed to the earlier revolutions. John Foran, you've identified something like 39 revolutions, and you've written about other kinds of mass transformations that have been occurring. I think you said there are three paths: revolution, autonomous spaces, and kind of via elections. How do we distinguish these, and what's different about them?
The 20th century was a very revolutionary period, particularly in what was known then as the Third World in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And in the course of that century, there were maybe five or six sort of great revolutions, so-called social revolutions, which transform not only government, but the whole social structure and sometimes the economy. And revolutions, by definition, also require the participation of mass numbers of people to make them. So a revolution is a way of making history by a society. And in these revolutions, the five or six principal revolutions of the 20th century, maybe starting with the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1920, the Russian Revolution, which was not a Third World Revolution, but took place in 1917, the Chinese Revolution, which spanned several decades before Mao Zedong and the communists came to power in China in 1949, the Cuban Revolution under Fidel Castro, which took power on January 1st, 1959, and in the year of 1979, two revolutions, one in Iran, which overthrew the Shah, and another in Nicaragua, which overthrew the dictator Anastasio Somoza. What all of these revolutions had in common and what distinguishes them from most of what we see in the 21st century, similar efforts to really transform society, is that they were made usually by armed guerrilla movements. They were headed by usually a single charismatic figure like Mao Zedong or Fidel Castro or Villa and Zapata in the Mexican Revolution. And they were therefore organized sort of hierarchically with a chain of command. By organizing that way, they were able to overthrow seemingly powerful governments, well-armed and often supported by powerful outside allies. But what happened typically afterwards was that you had a kind of hierarchical narrowing of the political system rather than a kind of general participation by the people, because they'd come to power through these hierarchical entities. In the 21st century, we're seeing not yet a so-called grand social revolution, but we're seeing a number of very interesting, what I would call movements for radical social change, which look very different. They are, by and large, nonviolent in their character. They are organized typically, as they say, more horizontally, more democratically, without always identifiable leaders. And they're advocating a new kind of society in a way that's a bit difficult to define in the 21st century. So I think that the nature of what used to be called revolution has changed, and I think that's a good thing. I think that the prospects for deep social change in this century, which I believe is necessary, are better because of the way that these movements have organized themselves. They have yet to succeed, but I think their prospects, should they ever do succeed, bode well for having a more kind of democratic and egalitarian outcome.
What do you attribute the change in strategy to, since you say we're by and large nonviolent now?
That's a good and hard question. These movements have made these decisions, and I think the first one to point to is the Zapatista uprising in southern Mexico, which took place in 1994. And they were an armed insurrection, but they very quickly became essentially a nonviolent force that concentrated on improving conditions in the very poor southern state of Chiapas. There's a kind of poetry to some of these movements, that is, the language and the sort of style and culture of these revolutions, I think, is simply a different kind of political culture that is more democratic, therefore, in a sense, less inclined to use violence, but nonetheless extremely radical and far-reaching in its vision for transforming societies.
Leandro Vergara Camus, I want to bring you in because he mentioned the Zapatistas. That's your area of studies. Do you see this the same way?
Yes, I think he's right. And it has to do, I think, a little bit at least with the ability of movement to learn. And the Zapatista movement learned from the guerrilla movements in Central America. And they learned that the use of violence brings attention, but it also brings more repression. So the Zapatista rose up in arm to bring attention to their struggles, to the centuries and decades of exploitation and marginalization. But they also knew that arms were not the path for radical social change. So the idea of the Zapatista was much more to bring awareness, but also generate some kind of movement towards autonomy within civil society in Mexico, even autonomy within civil society globally, and in order to deepen democracy and widen democracy. So not only understanding democracy in the sense of elections and political power, but also in terms of social justice, right to land, etc. So I think movements today in the 20th century are learning from what worked in the past and what needs to change.
One question about these movements for autonomy. I have a sense that I know what that means, but if you were going to look at it on the ground and describe it to somebody, what exactly does it look like?
Well, autonomy means the ability to decide on one's own life and one's own future. And it means the ability to not depend on either the state or the market for subsistence and for progress. So autonomy refers also to the ability of communities to find within themselves the resources and the strategies to go ahead.
Jack Goldstone.
I think there are some other things that we should note have changed. The societies in which those 20th century guerrilla revolutions occurred were mainly young, rural societies. And even if the revolution began in the capital city, the big task of revolutionaries was to take control of the countryside. And they had to defeat the existing state army. And both of those purposes required the revolutionaries to raise their own military force. The option of proceeding differently didn't really present itself as much as it does today. Today, governments are much more in the glare of international media, and so many, not all, I'll come to Syria in a minute, but many states are reluctant to unleash overwhelming force against their own people. And so what revolutionaries and movement leaders have discovered is that if they can occupy a public space,
and be firm and peaceful, then they can discourage the military and the government from attacking them. And if they stick to the nonviolence and stick to the occupation of space, they can often persuade the military to start to defect, and the government that opposes them backs down or in some cases runs away, as with Ben Ali in Tunisia or Yanukovych in Ukraine. So you have societies that are more sophisticated, better able to use media, facing governments that are usually more reluctant to unleash all the power of force. But as I say, they're exceptions. In Syria, what started out as a nonviolent resistance against the Assad regime was met with overwhelming force, and they had to turn to arms to defend themselves, and they continue to face a brutal life and death civil war. Fortunately, regimes that are willing to impose that kind of terror and damage on their own populations are much fewer today than in the past.
Although Libya, too, started out as a nonviolent protest, ended up in a violent conflict, but of course ended quite differently than Syria has so far.
You're quite correct, and it probably would have ended up in similar fashion to Syria if NATO had not intervened to disarm much of the heavy artillery and tank force that was being brought into position by Gaddafi. That did become a violent war, and unfortunately Libya is still racked by violence because the militias that were mobilized for that conflict have not gone away. I think that's one of the contrasts we see. Revolutions that start violently tend to stay violent for some time, whereas those that are able to change governments more peacefully are able to proceed to the tasks of putting together constitutions and building civil authorities without that kind of vicious conflict.
You have also written about the more current in our rearview mirror of yesterday, Ukraine, and also Thailand and Venezuela and Bosnia. You've said something like this is kind of a new wave of revolutionary movements.
I think that's right. They are new in the sense that John Foran mentioned. They are typically nonviolent. They're also taking place in much more advanced societies, both economically and politically, than the agrarian dictatorships that were overthrown in 20th century revolutions. These countries have started to make progress toward democracy. They have developed substantial urban middle classes. They tend to have pretty active media. And what we're seeing in this case is not so much people rising up against sheer poverty and oppression, as much as you're seeing the middle class and students taking the lead in demanding that their governments be more accountable, less corrupt, more constructive in meeting the needs of the people. I think these new movements, as John Foran said, are interesting partly because they don't have usually a kind of charismatic leader who's out to take control of society. They're rising up from a kind of diffuse middle class feeling that this government is doing us wrong. It's working for its own benefit and not ours, and we shouldn't have to tolerate that anymore at this point in the 21st century.
It seems to me, from what you've all said, that there are two forces of globalization going on at the same time that are contributing to this. One is, of course, we've got sort of the neoliberal economics that seems to be contrary to what some people actually desire for their everyday lives. But the second force is the role of how information is spreading and becoming a form of education for people if they do want to organize. John Foran?
What's new in the 21st century is that we're in the age of globalization. We're living in a global economy in which many argue that nation states don't have the power that they used to have. The global economy certainly is run by a relatively small number of very powerful corporations and banks and so forth. And there is a new type of revolution, if you will, that takes that into account and isn't aimed necessarily at a national state or taking power in a single country. And again, the Zapatistas, as Leandro mentioned, they inspired what became known as the global justice movement around the world, sort of linking young activists who thought that the problem was corporations and the problem was also the lack of democracy that existed because corporations could influence governments and elections so easily. And sort of the high watermark of the global justice movement was the 1999 shutdown of the World Trade Organization in Seattle by several thousand demonstrators who came from all points and sat down and engaged in acts of civil disobedience and blocked streets and prevented delegates from entering to negotiate the World Trade Organization's agenda, which was precisely to set the rules to make markets freer to this neoliberal economy that you alluded to. The other global movement, I think, that the one to watch and the one that I pay the most attention to and actually participate in myself now is known as the Global Climate Justice Movement. And that takes the ultimate, I think, global problem as its target, and that's, of course, the inexorable rise of climate change. And so this is very much a kind of networked, loose association of many groups across the world, and they do use the new social media that you raised in your question, and they use it to good effect.
So there seems to be simultaneous organizations and some that cross paths. And it's interesting in the age of decline in journalism with this rise of new media. Simultaneously, of course, we've got some countries, Turkey being the latest, that are trying to ban the use of social media like Twitter. How do you see this, Jack Goldstone?
This is really a futile effort and simply indicates how really frightened of open information for the public that leaders like Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan are. Now, in Egypt, there had been a lot of talk about social media being crucial, and certainly the initial organizers of the April 6th movement were very smart and managed to reach out to a few thousand people using social media. But the demonstrations were joined by people from all walks of life who communicated partly by telephone, by conversation, cell phone, seeing what was going on in the street. And when President Mubarak got alarmed and shut down social media, people left their computer screens, which had become uninteresting, and went out into the street in Tahrir Square because that's where the interesting buzz was happening. So in a sense, I think this is attacking the symptoms. People are anxious to communicate. They're anxious to share ideas. They'll do it by Twitter, they'll do it by Facebook, but they'll also do it by cell phone. Satellite and cable television has become a very big factor. It's hard to shut down all the TV stations, and people have found very clever ways of circumventing efforts to limit their access to internet, email, cell phones, and so on. Twitter, in fact, is broadcasting information on how to use SMS messaging to circumvent the curbs that Turkey has tried to put on Twitter. So I don't think you can stop people from reaching out to each other in this day and age unless you really want to use military force to isolate them. There are just too many avenues and channels now, and people have learned how to be flexible and really creative in using them. They're building local communities, global communities that intersect across different kinds of boundaries, and that has made it much harder to suppress these kind of popular movements that have arisen in this century.
Leandra Vergara-Camu, let's bring you back in here. You've talked both about this sort of education and information age as well, and the Zapatistas, I think, were one of the first to use the internet to communicate with the world. I want to go to this information piece. One other aspect of your work looks at this sort of moving back and forth between non-capitalist relations within the organization, within the movement, but then having to go back out and have capitalist relations with the outside world. How does this all work?
Technology, I think, is a very important issue, but it's been, I would say, overblown, because the strength of the Zapatista is not in their use of technology. The strength of the Zapatista is that they've been able to bring together a variety of communities that are isolated into one organization that has managed to politicize their members by distributing power within communities in discussion. The decisions are taken in assemblies. People that didn't have the right to voice in the rural communities in Mexico because they didn't have right to land were given political rights within Zapatista communities. So they brought in people that had been disenfranchised from the political system in Mexico, but also from the rural community, the villages. So by bringing people in, by making them participate, you politicize them, and you create a sense of community, you create a sense of an ability to change one's life, and you empower people. So mainly the strength of organization that I have studied, at least like the Zapatista or the MST, the strength is that they're able to control a territory or a space. Then they're able to politicize members of those communities through allowing them to participate in taking decision, in thinking about strategies, in learning how to confront power. At the same time that they're learning how to confront power, they're also learning how to take power, to take control. Not only take control of the political process within their community, but also taking control of land and then being able to feed their families, being able to start producing. In the case, for example, of the MST, after a few years, they are able to start integrating the market. And very often they, compared to other types of actors, because they control land, they're able to at least get around the market for one essential need that we all have, is to feed ourselves. So that gives them kind of margin of maneuver that other actors do not have. And it also allows this movement to be stronger. The technology is something that facilitates all that, but it's not the essential ingredient.
There are two things that I think you bring up here. One is that, first of all, the Zapatistas and the MST, the Brazilian landless movement, are among the poorest people who have organized. And yet that seems to be an anomaly if we look at Jack Goldstone's work. Mostly, it seems like the movements tend to be driven by the middle class. The second piece, which is something that I think John Foran has written about, is that it's not so much ideology driving as it may have been in the 20th century, but about everyday life. John Foran, that seems to be a prime difference between 20th and 21st century movements.
I would agree with that. My basic starting point for studying revolutions has been just that, that revolutions, in fact, are made certainly by people. People have to become active in large numbers to make a revolution, and you have to ask the question of how does that happen? And one of the most general ways in which that happens is people begin to elaborate a critique of the existing system, whether it be the lack of political freedom or whether it's their economic circumstances. And sometimes they do this in very sort of ordinary language. You know, they talk about bread. They want freedom. They want to govern themselves. And you don't really need an ideology. In the 20th century, most of the great social revolutions did have an ideology, and that was socialism. In the 21st century, they are much more loosely organized. I think that's, again, part of this whole constellation of things that make the 21st century different, that people are not going to necessarily agree on a single well-defined ideology is one point. And another is that people, I think, want to make their own sort of culture of resistance. And that varies widely, but it's found in every revolution.
Jack Goldstone, what about this anomaly? You may not call it a revolution in this case because you've distinguished this out.
I think it's a mistake to try and fit all revolutions into a single pattern or box, even if you differentiate there's a 20th century pattern and a 21st century pattern, because these are creations of human beings, and so there'll always be exceptions and innovations. What you have in the cases you mentioned, the Zapatistas and the Brazilian land movement, they are movements of the poor, but they decided to be more peaceful and use media rather than guns to achieve their objectives. So they may have drawn on different groups, but they absorbed some of the lessons that other groups had followed in the same time. I mentioned Thailand as a place where the middle class is up in arms, and that's true in Bangkok. But it's also the case that poorer people in the northern part of the country have mobilized to defend what they see as their champion, Yingluck Shinawatra, the current prime minister. So what you see throughout the world is a variety of different contexts, a variety of different peoples what we've seen in the last couple of years in Ukraine, in places like Kiev and in Bangkok and now in Caracas and Venezuela, are movements in which the middle class is taking a leading role in demanding more genuinely democratic and accountable governments. But there are other places in the world where the poor or people who are facing ethnic discrimination or who have regions that have been treated badly are also mobilizing and absorbing some of the same lessons, using some of the same ideas and tactics and tools to pursue their goals.
If I can jump in, one thing also that needs to be taken into consideration when we think about revolution is that there's never a revolution that is made only by one class. All the revolution have always involved multi-class alliances. And one of the most important factor, I think, in any successful revolution is a split at the level of the ruling class. If there's no split at the level of the ruling class, there won't be a revolution. There needs to be some kind of split at the top so that the pressure that comes from below can change the situation.
Yeah, this is Jack Goldstone. I fully agree. It generally is the case that the bigger the change, the more the rulers need to be in a divided and vulnerable position, and the more you need really broad alliances between different groups in society trying to create change.
We had another scholar, Erica Chenoweth, on our program. She's done this study that looked at successful revolutions and found that the nonviolent ones are far more successful than the violent ones. Do you also find that to be the case?
This is John Foran. I tried to argue that in general, not in all cases, that is the way of the 21st century. And I would be remiss not to include in this conversation another path to power, which is simply for radical forces to come to power in an election, in a democratic election. And the now classic examples of this are the quite radical governments that have been elected in the last 15 years in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, that together with other Latin American countries are known as the Pink Tide. Pink because their radical political and economic projects, which are socialist or 21st century socialists, as they sometimes call them, are wedded with democracy. And again, a shift from 20th century taking of power by single parties. And I think this is also a sign of the 21st century because in Latin America, at least in the 20th century, it was very difficult for a party to the left of center to come to power. If it came to power, as in the case of Chile under Allende in 1970, it faced extreme external opposition from powerful actors like the United States and its own internal elite. And in the 21st century, it seems a lot harder to dislodge governments that have been democratically elected. They have simply got more legitimacy. Case in point being in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez won election after election. And when the military and the elite rose against him in a coup in 2002, they were unable to sustain that coup because people came out and opposed it. And also because his government was seen as legitimately elected by all their neighbors, the Organization of American States, not a single country except the United States, which is a member, supported that coup. And that sort of legitimacy that comes with that also, I think, saved him in that situation. But these are governments that come to power with a more or less radical agenda and try to legislate the changes, the social programs to benefit people that a revolutionary government might do. And I think they are a form of 21st century revolutions. They're democratic revolutions.
When we're talking about really more or less the global south, moving a little bit more to the left with these agendas. Meanwhile, it seems like the global north or the first world, but including Australia and New Zealand, have really kind of electorally moved to the right. Is there any way to bridge these and try to understand what's going on globally, or is that too big of a question?
I don't think it's too big a question. I think it is the big question. And, you know, you put your finger on this very important trend that we're seeing growth in inequality around the world, and in the developed countries, it's being supported by governments who are committed to making the world an easier place for businesses to thrive, but are not as committed to making the world a place where ordinary workers and young people looking for their first job can thrive. Now, they're making that decision, I think, based on what they're told about the need to be competitive and to be business friendly and hoping it will work out. But we're certainly seeing a challenge to that notion, and the challenge is even stronger in developing countries where governments tend to be more corrupt. They're not just setting rules in favor of business, they're kind of breaking or discarding rules and leaving people really desperate to find a way to escape from a kind of top-down business and corruption that is hurting their chances to move forward. So I think we're going to see this become a global struggle in which the kind of emerging working and middle classes in the developing world may be leading the way in demanding governments that work to support their interests and not so much the interests of business leaders and elites.
Leandro Vergara Camus.
I think what we can see in these 30 years of neoliberalism is that neoliberal hegemony is much more stronger in the north than it is in the south. The left-wing parties in Italy, in France, in Germany, in the UK went really, really far away from what they were in the 70s and in the 60s. If you think of the Third Way, for example, you wonder if it's really a party of the left. The union movement also has been hit very hard in these decades of neoliberalism in the North. So that has been the case also in the South, but in the South, movement have managed to reemerge. Some of them have moved away from political parties that were too on the right for them, and others have managed to create new parties, like in Bolivia and in Ecuador, for example. The indigenous movement was able to create their own political party that represented their own interest instead of aligning themselves with old left-wing parties that were also moving towards the center. So the political dynamics of the different regions are completely different. But this distinction, I think, between the strength of the neoliberal hegemony in the North versus in the South is an important difference.
Thank you to the three of you for joining us. It's been a great pleasure having you.
Thanks for the opportunity to join you tonight.
Thank you very much.
Leandro Vergara Camus is professor at the Department of Development Studies at the University of London. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Land and Freedom, the MST, the Zapatistas, and Peasant Alternatives to Neoliberalism. John Foran is professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of The Future of Revolutions, Rethinking Radical Change in an Age of Globalization, and Taking Power on the Origins of Revolutions in the Third World. Jack Goldstone is professor of public policy at George Mason University. He's the author of Revolution and Rebellion in the Early Modern World and Revolutions, a Very Short Introduction. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.